Welcome to The Gould Standard, a new podcast presented by the Glenn Gould Foundation. We'll be speaking with some fascinating people from across the world of the arts. Some will be well known to you, some less so, but each of them has a fantastic story or two to tell. My name is Brian Levine, and I'm happy to be with you as we take these little trips together into the world of the fantastic. And if you enjoy what you hear, be sure to press like, subscribe, and share. Post your comments, tell your friends, hell, tell your enemies. They might just become your friends too. Because, well, you never know. The arts do have a way of bringing people together and building community. Speaking about uniting things and people that don't normally hang together, imagine someone who writes award-winning science fiction, graphic novels, stands at the cutting edge of digital rights activism, and is also one of the most interesting and eclectic bloggers anywhere. I couldn't be more happy than to kick off this series with our guest today, Cory Doctorow. Welcome, Cory.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Now, speaking with Cory is a little like having a conversation with three or even more people. Cory, as I mentioned, is a best-selling science fiction writer with a body of work spanning 14 novels, including the soon-to-be-released Attack Surface, the third installment in his best-selling Little Brother series. He's also running a concurrent Kickstarter campaign to fund the creation of an audiobook version of Attack Surface, which you can support, and I hope you will. Then there's Cory, the activist, who has worked with organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, was an early adopter of the Creative Commons, and many, many other organizations dedicated to promoting freedom of expression in the online world, freedom from what we can describe as corporate and state intrusion and surveillance, and navigating the delicate slalom path for artists and creators to combine openness with being able to thrive financially. Together with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as an example of his activism, he is currently engaged with a Mexican constitutional challenge over the digital rights management provisions being enacted as part of the USMCA. Then there's Cory the blogger, whose opinions can be found on Boing Boing and Pluralistic.net on everything from economics to movies to politics, art, the news, and of course, the latest developments in information technology and those who demand that the digital world be just, equitable, and free. His new nonfiction book is called, rather politely, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. And add to that, teacher, a not very conventional academic, researcher, entrepreneur, dedicated family man, and of course, by birth, a Torontonian. Welcome, the whole gang of you.
Well, thank you very much. We're all glad to be here.
That's great. I'm glad that we have a wide enough angle lens to take all of you in. I want to start with a little quote that goes way back to an interview you did just after the publication of your first novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And I quote, "Walt Disney was part of a tradition of crypto-fascist utopian American squillionaires that included Henry Ford. Now, Canadians in general, and Torontonians in particular, tend to be a sedate lot, respectful of orderliness and authority, given to apologizing at the drop of a hat. What happened to you?"
I don't know. I mean, you know, there is that old joke that the way you find a Canadian in a crowded elevator is to step on everyone's foot until someone apologizes. But, you know, whenever I hear that joke, I think, well, that is a highly selective account of Canadianness, because if you were Indigenous, it wouldn't work because Canadians will never apologize to Indigenous people, right? And so, you know, I think that that much vaulted Canadian deference is often is like unidirectional. It moves up the social gradient, but not down the social gradient. And, you know, I grew up with radical politics in Toronto. I was part of the anti-nuclear proliferation movement. I was mentored by Judith Merrill, the titan of writing and criticism and activism. My parents were political activists. The first time I was ever in the newspaper was a picture in the Toronto Star at a benefit for Henry Morgenthaler, where he's holding me up in the air, you know, so I guess it came naturally.
Well, you know, just in case you'd like to reclaim your Canadianness, after that statement, if you'd like to apologize, say you're sorry now.
Yeah, I'm heartily sorry to Indigenous people for Canada. Yes.
All right. Yeah, poor Walt Disney. He'll just have to make do. But
yeah, Walt's fine. You know, in fact, his descendants are doing a better job of excoriating him these days than I ever did. You know, he's got this Abigail Disney, his great niece, who's made a second career after being quite a good documentarian, made a second career out of showing up on TV to decry inherited wealth and the actions of the executives of the Walt Disney Company. So, you know, he doesn't need me. He's got unlike descendants of great people who spend all of their time, you know, free riding on their ancestors' achievements, like Stephen Joyce, James Joyce's grandson. Walt Disney's grandkids are certainly giving him what for.
Yeah, that's right. And that's not to take away from the fact that in that same interview, you said that you were an unabashed fan of Walt Disney World. And so, you know,
sure,
I guess take the bitter with the sweet.
You gotta love the sin and hate the sinner.
Exactly. You didn't really have that conventional an education growing up. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how that contributed to your childhood activism and the activism you've been going on with ever since?
Yeah, I was very lucky to grow up at a time in Toronto when there was a public budget for alternative schools that emphasized self-directed education. And I went to school with a great bunch of kids who sort of self-selected for their curiosity and their interest in self-directed learning. The alumna from my elementary years that I think most people would know is Tim Wu, the guy who coined the term net neutrality. But the whole gang were a really interesting lot. And mm-hmm. I ended up in alternative secondary schools, primarily Seed School, which was then at College and Yonge. And Seed School really emphasized self-directed learning to the point where I spent a year not getting any credits and instead organizing street demonstrations against George H.W. Bush's invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And another year not getting any credits because I spent most of it with a word processor in a little town in Mexico writing. That 7-year high school career actually did wonders for me and exposed me to sort of tools and ideas, organizing principles that really stood me in good stead. I mean, it's effectively in some ways like going to grad school in that like no one bails you out if you don't do the work.
Right.
And so, you know, you are left to sink. And then when you find yourself having sunk far enough and you want to do more traditional educational or pedagogical activities, the faculty were there to kind of pull you out and dust you off and get you going. But, you know, that journey of figuring out what you want to do when there's no constraint is one of the things that I think has helped me navigate a whole life of an unconventional career where if I don't show up, not only does no one pay me, but no one tells me I've done a bad job either.
In that kind of environment, presumably you got comfortable with the idea that you could call bullshit on something, even if it was in a book or if someone was standing in front of you in a classroom saying it was so.
Well, and also, you know, interrogating systems, what the Sense About Science campaign in the UK calls the ask for evidence. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, when confronted with an authority that tells you a thing must be a certain way, just ask them why and ask them to show their work and to, you know, I mean, I don't want to say it's not adversarial. It's obviously adversarial, but not cynically, right? Not in bad faith. Right. If the evidence is good, then fine. But ask for the evidence when you're asked to do something that seems nonsensical. And, you know, also pick your battles. So when I was finally ready to graduate after 7 years of secondary school, I had gotten, you know, all the core credits I needed and the final year credits, what were then called OACs. I don't think they have them anymore in Ontario, sort of like A-levels in the UK. But I didn't have the bulk. I was short 14 credit or 16 credits or something for my diploma, like more than half.
Right.
And so I just went and read the curriculum. And it turned out that you could get a diploma and it would be a first class diploma. You could be an Ontario scholar and whatnot, only on the basis of the credits that I had. And all of the other credits were irrelevant, provided that they had passing grades. So I found the distance education materials for all of the 9th grade basic stream courses and knocked them off. They were all half credit courses and knocked each of them off in about an hour and got my diploma. And so that kind of approach to apply rigor where needed, to call bullshit, to seek evidence, and to when you found that you'd run up against a brick wall, rather than beating your brains out against it, figuring out how to, you know, maybe tunnel under it, was all a really critical part of my secondary education, right, for sure.
And along with that, not stifling your sense of imagination and fantasy, which obviously stood you in good stead later on.
Sure. Yeah. And I started writing as a kid, and, you know, I don't believe in talent. I think talent is just, you know, doing something for a while without applying yourself to it and not noticing that you're practicing because it's fun.
Right.
And then when you sit down to do it in earnest, you've already acquired some praxis, you know, through that practice. And, you know, then often the feeling of easy mastery, right, when you actually apply yourself to it and discover that you're already, quote unquote, good at it, it gives you the lift that you need to keep practicing. But, you know, the idea that there's like a genetic basis, right, for like making up stories about rocket ships seems like wildly improbable. You
know? Yeah, I would imagine. But you put your finger on something, which is, you know, you get your 10,000 hours by being so absorbed in it that you don't notice the 10,000 hours passing.
Or at least you get the first ones, right? You prime the pump by doing it when it's fun. And I actually think that one of the hard transitions in the arts is moving from an inspiration-based practice to a daily work practice. You know, for me, the thing that enabled me to do that was the ultimately kind of mixed blessing of realizing that though there were days when I felt like the words that I'd written were very good and days when I felt like the words I'd written were really terrible, and though in retrospect, when I reread the work, there were parts that needed work and parts that were very good, that all of those were completely unrelated. Mm-hmm. That the way I felt about the work was not a factor of how good the work was. It was a factor of like how my anxiety levels and blood sugar and stress levels and sleep were, and not the quality of the work. And so, you know, on the one hand, this is a very liberating realization because it frees you up to work even on days when the work seems bad, because it might be good, right? You can't know until you're done. On the other hand, that it's over the long term, I think, makes your work somewhat anhedonic, right? Because the joy you feel when you feel like you're really producing, if you're going to be really honest with yourself, you have to admit that that joy is probably has more to do with your like limbic system than it does with any kind of artistic merit of the work that you're doing. Or if it does, that there it's a wholly coincidental. And so then eventually it becomes a thing that you do, right? It becomes a habit. And habits are good, right? Like the way that you get inspiration is to sit in the chair and to put your fingers on the keyboard and write, irrespective of whether inspiration has been lured into the room. And on some days you get lucky and on some days you don't. Yeah. But you just do the work every day. You show up so that when the inspiration is there, you're there too with your fingers on the keyboard. But it does change things from that, like, I'm a person who does many things, but periodically I'm inspired and I sit down and write, to I'm a writer and my job is writing, in the same way that the person who takes away my trash bin's job is to take away my trash bins, and the person who takes on my gallbladder's job is to take on my gallbladder. And all of us have days when we don't feel like doing the work and we all show up anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's an interesting point about, you know, getting the perspective that a little extra time provides that gets you beyond that sort of rush. Sometimes I think it's just getting from where you started to some kind of a destination that gives you a bit of a charge. I think it was some buzzkill Greek philosopher who advised a young poet to take his poems and put them in a drawer for 7 years and then take them out to figure out if they were any good.
Well, although in his defense, Greek drawers had great poetry improving capabilities. They one of the lost bits of art that they tried to recover in the Renaissance and never mastered again. No, it's true. I mean, you know, one of the things about critiquing circles is that I think a lot of people get involved in critiquing circles with the expectation that they will both have praise heaped upon them and also that whatever flaws are in their work will be identified by their colleagues and rooted out and you know, better alternatives suggested to perfect their work. And if you're lucky, some of that stuff happens. But I think the main function of a critiquing circle is to train yourself to be productively critical of other people's work in the hopes that eventually you can turn that productive criticality on your own work.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's, again, you get very lucky if your critiquing circle consistently gives you great advice. They do often tell you where things have gone wrong. They just don't often know how to make it right.
Right. As long as it doesn't have that quality of, you know, the re-education camp where, you know, people sit around and criticize each other mercilessly.
Sure, they can certainly be very taught. Struggle sessions, Maoist struggle sessions for sure. Yes,
exactly.
And I mean, back to Judith Merrill, I was very lucky that the critiquing circles I was involved in were all started by Judy, although I didn't know it. So the secondary school I went to, Seed School, Judy had gotten a Toronto School Board grant to do a Writers in the School program and had set up the writing workshop at Seed a decade before I got there. And it was, you know, the norms that she set and the procedures that she set were so effective that it was still going a decade later and may be going to this day.
Yeah.
She also, you know, I used to watch her on TV as a kid because she used to introduce Doctor Who on TV Ontario.
Yep.
My dad and I would watch it when my mom was doing her master's and he would babysit me and my kid brother. And I would sit there watching Doctor Who, and my dad knew Judy from Radical Politics. And then I would watch her do her thing. And when I was 9 or 10, I went on a school trip to her library, to what was then called the Spaced Out Library.
Just down the road from Captain George's Memory Lane.
That's right. Well, and you know, now it's moved over to it's called the Merrill Collection. When she retired, they let her rename it, and it's down at College in Spadina. But I went on a school trip, and Judy was the writer in residence at the Merrill, at the Spaced Out Library.
Yeah.
And she told this group of 10-year-olds, look, if you write any stories, bring them down and I'll help you out with them. Right. And this was Judith Merrill, right?
Unbelievably generous.
And a towering figure in the field, right? It's like Picasso, but you know, without the womanizing assholery, announcing to a group of finger painters that if they have any work they'd like to show them, he'll give them a few tips. I mean, it was remarkable. And I started bringing her manuscripts, as did so many other writers from around the city. And what Judy did was she pieced us together. She would say, you, you're all kind of temperamentally suited to one another. You're working at about the same level. We have an extra room here at the Spaced Out Library that you can meet in. Go and have a workshop. And that workshop that she put me in is still going. It's called the Cecil Street Irregulars, and Peter Watts and Madeline Ashby and Carl Schrader and David Nickel and many other writers have cycled through it. Many of them are still in it now. It's, you know, it's one of those lasting, enduring bits of Judy's legacy.
That's fantastic. Well, growing up in the midst of the internet revolution, it must have seemed to you that, and to the technically engaged cohort that you were part of, that you were really on the verge of some sort of utopian brave new world where everything was going to be possible and all of it would be good because, you know, it's like Bacon, you know, to make all things possible happen, right?
Right.
And, you know, it's going to be a world filled with wonders right out of science fiction, but brought to life. But as time has passed, things seem to have shifted towards a more dystopian reality. How have those changes been reflected in the evolution of your own writing? And is science fiction and speculative fiction, to your way of thinking, the best medium for shining a light on where we are in the present?
Yeah, I want to quibble slightly with that characterization. I mean, obviously, when I was a kid, I was very excited by things. But I think that the utopian wing of the digital rights world was never blind to the possibilities that things could go horribly wrong. Indeed, like, you don't start an organization like the Electronic Frontier Foundation because you think things will be fine, right? You do it because on the one hand, you are very excited about the possibilities, but on the other, you are scared out of your wits by how badly things could go.
Right.
You know, the Michael Weinberger, a cyber lawyer, wrote a paper for Public Knowledge about 3D printing and copyright called "This Will All Be So Great If We Don't Screw It Up."
Yeah.
And, you know, I want that on my tombstone, you know, like it's such a motto for the ages, you know. So I think that what I underestimated back in those days was just how complacent governments would be about mergers and concentration in the industry, because I'm not a tech exceptionalist in the traditional sense. Like, I don't think that we can use technology and cryptography to build a like stable demimond that can live to one side of an illegitimate state and protect all the people inside it with its perfect cryptography. But I am a tech exceptionalist in the sense that I understand that there are technical elements of computers, right? The character of being universal machines, right? That computers can run every program that we can express in symbolic logic. And every computer can run every program that yeah. even the oldest, most primitive computers could run the most modern programs, albeit very, very slowly. And that because of this universality, that there is an intrinsic disruptibility, right? This is where the doctrine of disruption has some real merit and isn't just empty platitudes. That anything that exists, any old iron, can have something new plugged into it, irrespective of the wishes of its manufacturer, and that this allows new entrants into the market to treat the walled gardens, the network effects that are the defensive bulwark of the incumbents, instead as handy corrals in which their prey animals have been neatly organized for them to go and raid. You know, so yeah. when Facebook started, you know, callow Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm had a problem, which was that the evil billionaire Rupert Murdoch had bought MySpace, which was the place where everybody who understood why you would ever use social media made their home. And that no matter how good Facebook was, MySpace users would always find that there was an advantage that MySpace had that Facebook didn't, which is that all their friends were there.
Right.
And rather than convincing them to solve this collective action problem, which would have been an impossibility, and this is what we mean when we say that there's network effects that defend incumbents that dominate their industry. Instead, they built a tool where you could give it your login and password for MySpace, and it would go and get your waiting MySpace messages and put them in your Facebook inbox. Right. And you could reply to them, and it would push them back out to MySpace. Right. And so MySpace became not an impregnable walled garden, but rather like a handy source of nutrition that Facebook could use to bulk up on the cheap.
Right.
And So long as the industry was disorganized, so long as there was competition and there were people rudely shouldering each other aside and there wasn't a concert of interests, so long as it was composed of people who had been this geographically dispersed and diffused group of people who never knew that they loved computers until they first met one and they were like, where have you been all my life?
Right.
And who therefore didn't have this kind of cozy old boys network because they were not credentialed. They were coming from, you know, the basements and spare rooms of suburban houses around the world as they discovered the beauty and power of digital technology and networks. Then there would always be someone who would defect from whatever consensus the industry thought the government should enact in order to protect the people who'd won the last round of musical chairs and stop the music. And I didn't understand that the Mulroney, Reagan, Thatcher, Pinochet, Helmut Kohl era had been the last gasp of effective anti-monopoly enforcement, and that we had effectively stopped enforcing anti-monopoly law. And, you know, to my credit, I was 9.
Right.
But also to my credit, the lawyers in the incumbent firms didn't understand it either, right? IBM didn't understand that when the Department of Justice let it off the hook in 1982 and dropped its 12-year enforcement action, that it wasn't waiting to pounce on IBM if it put a foot wrong. Right. They didn't know that. They were still traumatized by 12 years of being dragged up and down a gravel road, you know, by the ankles, by the DOJ. And so when Phoenix Computers, which was this little tiny startup, hired this queer network engineer named Tom Jennings, who lives about 2 miles from here and is a pal of mine now, to reverse engineer the ROM of the IBM PC and make a chip that they could sell to Compaq and Gateway and Dell and every other vendor to make copies of its crown jewels, of its new PC, they thought that they should exercise forbearance because the DOJ would come after them.
Right.
They were wrong. The DOJ was done. The DOJ had spent the last of its dry powder and had no life in it and would never fire another shot, right? Microsoft was a damp squib. And after that, it was just all downhill. Yep. And now we arrive at a web that consists of 5 giant websites filled with screenshots from the other 4. And the firms have converged on a set of lobbying terms, and they have gone up this interoperability ladder that allowed them to disrupt the firms that came before them. And then they've kicked it away with the help of government, enacting cybersecurity laws, copyright laws, patent laws, trade secrecy, exotic theories of copyright, like the one Oracle is pursuing against Google over APIs and so on, that allow them to prevent anyone from doing unto them what they had done unto others.
Right.
And with this convergence of all of these firms into these mega firms that control so much of our digital destiny, just as so much of our life is becoming digital. We see a fusion of the state in its most illegitimate guise, right? In its desire to enact universal surveillance and control, and these large firms that give it the material to do it. And to the extent that you would hope that there would be a disconfluence of interest, where there would be an equilibrium, where the state acts as a watchdog on the firms and the firms, you know, fight back against overreach of the state. Instead, you see them working hand in hand and forming a kind of fusion. And, you know, everything that you would hope might disrupt that, like the trade war with China, only strengthens it. So the trade war with China has the great and the good on Parliament Hill and in Westminster and in DC saying, you know, we can't afford to weaken our technical giants because they are our national champions that will defend us against Chinese hegemony. When in fact, what they are is they're lazy, squatting monopolists holding back progress the way AT&T was.
Right.
Right. In 1982, they broke up AT&T and they said, oh, Japan will destroy the American electronics industry. Well, it turned out that AT&T's pet project had been suppressing modems. Right. And that, like, breaking up AT&T, far from delivering dominance over the electronics industry to Japan, instead unshackled American technological entrepreneurship and innovation from the ossifying dead hand of AT&T and its 100-year monopoly, and allowed them to destroy the Japanese electronics industry. Right. And, yeah. And, you know, it's like, it is a worst of all worlds. And you're right. We got it wrong, but we didn't get it wrong because we didn't think things could go wrong. We got it wrong because we misunderstood the equilibrium, because we misunderstood just how willing to entertain oligarchy our, you know, fallen and degenerate states had become from the moment of pluralism that we saw in the post-war era to the stagnation of the late 70s.
Right. I'm guessing that you've read or you're familiar with Matt Stoller's recent book, Goliath.
Certainly, yeah. Which, yeah, I know Matt too, yeah.
Yeah, which puts this all in a larger transition away from anti-monopoly to where we are across the economy. And it's obviously pretty disturbing. But, you know, it's also possible at some point that there will be, you know, an opportunity for leaders, if sufficiently pressured by the public, to break free of it. It may happen incrementally, but typically these things happen in spurts, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. And by the way, I do want to apologize for that remark about utopianism, because, of course, you know, no one who ever wrote utopian fiction could have done so while an adolescent. Right. That's not possible. And a lot of you guys were during that formative period. All right. So, Corey, your 2019 collection of four novellas, Radicalized, actually a copy of which I hold in my hand. It's a superb, wonderful book. It ends with a tribute to my personal favorite among all of Edgar Allan Poe's stories, Mask of the Red Death. It's your own take on it with the same title. And among other things, it rather presciently features a rather civilization crashing pandemic, although that's not the only factor, as in our times. Can you talk a little bit about that piece and what it says about the moment we're living in, even if you weren't specifically expecting a pandemic to come along and make you a perfect fortune teller? I know science fiction writers say, no, we're not predictors, but as it happens, you got it right on this one.
Well, I mean, the idea that things might go horribly awry is not itself pessimistic, right? Engineers who design systems on the assumption that they'll never break down are not good engineers. They're idiots, right? In fact, they're homicidal idiots. They're the people who decided that the Titanic couldn't possibly need any lifeboats, you know? So I don't think...
Or that MCAS was going to be a perfect situation.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you know, second law of thermodynamics has not been repealed. Things tend towards chaos. Things fall apart. And imagining how we might bring the machine to a graceful stop and restart it rather than having it kind of, you know, shower us with white hot shrapnel as it explodes into a million fragments is in some ways an optimistic or at least a hopeful exercise. And we live at the end of the 40-year experiment of neoliberal individualism and the idea that we have no shared destiny, that in time of crisis, that what we need to do is look out for ourselves. And this is obviously wrong. I mean, you know, that there's no way we resolve a crisis without, you know, all of us pitching in, not least because we see that when things go wrong, that there are cascades, right? That the pandemic is bad enough, but a pandemic and a tornado requires a kind of labor-intensive rescue effort that really beggars the imagination, or a pandemic and a wildfire, that, you know, as the resilience starts to fray, we need more and more backs. And yet we have against this the prepper movement. And the prepper movement is a very curious thing. Certainly there are elements of the prepper movement that are, you know, working class people who imagine either that their neighbors are no good or that the state is no good. But the vanguard of the prepper movement is rich people.
Yep.
And there's a curious thing about preppers as an anthropologically considered group, which is that each prepper, when they imagine the end of the world that they imagine is not an end of the world that's selected for its likeliness. It's selected for their salience to it, right? That, you know, that everybody wants an end of the world in which they matter. So, you know, there's an anthropologist who's gone and talked to preppers, and he talks to a prepper whose career had been in water safety. And this guy has spent his whole retirement prepping for the disaster in which terrorists poison the water supply. Not because he thinks that's likely, right? Because if they did, it would be so cool, because he would be the hero, right? And he would matter. This guy who was a technical functionary who did a good job that was important his whole life, but that no one ever thanked and no one ever cared about, would suddenly become the savior of civilization. Now, when plutocrats imagine a crisis in which they are somehow important, it's kind of, they have to go to some pretty far lengths, because, you know, what does someone who is expert at manipulating share prices or finding loopholes in international tax law, or, you know, stealing Mountain Equipment Co-op from its members, right? What do they have to offer at the end of the world? And inevitably, what they have to offer is sociopathy that is so much more sociopathic than the common or garden sociopaths that they are certain lurk in all of our breasts, that will be unleashed by the falling away of civilizational chains, that they can emerge after, you know, lesser people who don't understand the way of the world have gone and gotten the sanitation and the water going again. They can emerge with their hard drives full of Bitcoin and their gemstone quality rubies and their AR-15s and their, you know, mercenary cadres, and assemble a harem and live out like a perpetual Frazetta painting. And, you know, that vision is not only like risible in its idiocy, but it's flimsy, because none of that stuff has anything to do with the obvious shared destiny that is revealed, particularly in a crisis with an epidemiological character, or a crisis that reveals an epidemiological character, right? The earthquake might not be what gets you. What might get you is the collapse of the sanitation afterward. My grandmother, who is Russian, you know, her husband, my grandfather, was Polish, and she lived in Poland for a little while after the war. And the only Polish word she ever taught me was cholera, which is the all-purpose Polish curse that just means cholera.
Yes.
Right. And it's such a potent curse, because anyone who's ever lived through a cholera epidemic knows that it is a terror almost without parallel, right? That sanitation is such a critical function of our society, and it's literally the plumbing, right? We literally just ignore it because it's the plumbing in the bowels of the earth. And the idea that like any of what these Ubermenschen do has any utility if the plumbers aren't on the job reveals such a crazy blind spot in their thinking, you know?
That reminds me of a couple of different things. Rutger Bregman's Utopia for Realists, in which he posits the argument that garbage collectors are actually more important than bankers. And because, you know, bankers went on strike once in the UK and nobody noticed, but they went on strike in New York for a couple of months, and believe me, everybody noticed. And obviously that becomes much more poignant now with the plight of essential workers during the pandemic, who still, you know, in Rodney Dangerfield fashion, don't get no respect. The other thing that's a little farther back that I think is perhaps a little less directly germane is the one and only time I heard Isaac Asimov speak, which was back, I think, in 1976 at the World Science Fiction Convention. He was asked about racial superiority theories, and he said, "I'll take them seriously when a respected scientist gets up and says, I have proven that one race is superior to another, but unfortunately, I'm not part of that race."
Yeah. Well, this was David Suzuki arguing with that old Nazi, I forget his name, you know, Canadian Nazi, who had his cranial capacity theories. And Suzuki got up and said, you know, "You claim Asians have bigger heads than white people and therefore have more brains and therefore are smarter. I am Asian and I'm here to tell you that you're full of it. Therefore, you're wrong. Therefore, I'm right. Therefore, the cranial," you know, it was a funny little.
Yes.
But, you know, there's some really interesting work being done now on rebutting the eugenics movement, because it has become so pernicious. Adam Rutherford is a genomist and science communicator. He's got a show on the BBC, and he's just published a book called How to Argue with a Racist. And it's a really good, sprightly little, very funny pamphlet. Like, imagine if, you know, Douglas Adams was a genomist who was taking on racism. And if you know Anne Innes Dagg, who just won the Order of Canada, Harold Innes's daughter, who was my old Waterloo advisor, is a biologist who has made her life's work criticism of Darwinian psychology. He really borrows a lot from this, you know, these cod evolutionary theories of human action. And Anne was the first person to really open my eyes to it. She wrote a very good little book called Love of Shopping is Not a Gene. And, you know, I don't know that this is an actual quote, but it made me realize that, like, the like kind of platonic ideal of a evolutionary psych course is, honey, it's not my fault. The reason I'm fucking my grad students is bonobos, you know? and you know they just find an animal, cherry pick it, and have it explain why you have no choice but to act as you do. See, for example, Jordan Peterson and his goddamn lobsters.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, I think, that we seem to be in a kind of eternal return where we're back in social Darwinism, but in a new form. And the social Darwinism is around, you know, who, you know, can manage to come up with the algorithm that basically steals the most financial assets or leverages them out of nothing. Right. And that clearly makes you evolutionarily superior. And, you know, the natural maker and everyone else is a taker, even though they're actually paying taxes and you're driving on the roads. Anyway, I digress.
I mean, you know, look, that there's a very good political scientist called Corey Robin, who wrote a book called The Reactionary Mind, did a second edition for the Trump era. That's a history of right-wing thought. And he asks this really critical question: why do we call all of these different schools of thought, dominionism and imperialism and financialism and, you know, eugenics, white supremacy and so on, how can they all be right-wing? They are, when you drill into them, they're very different. What do they have in common? He says the thing they have in common is the thing that the right wing has had in common since the reaction, since the French Revolution. And it's the belief that some people are born to rule.
Yep.
And that the world is set in its rotation and everything is good when the natural rulers rule and everyone else takes their orders and shuts up. And it goes to Plato. And there is a seductiveness to that. And, you know, it's the rare person who adheres to that ideology who doesn't also think that they aren't part of the group. Although, you know, you do have women who are dominionists who think that men should boss around women. And one of the things that Robin talks about is that the utility of this ideology, the way that you get turkeys to vote for Christmas, is by setting people in a hierarchy where maybe they're not at the top, but they're not at the bottom either.
Right.
And he talks about how one of the great projects of the slave owning South was to convince poor white people to own slaves, so that they would feel like they were invested in the system that was not just unequal in the sense that some people were considered property and other people were considered fully enfranchised humans, but also wildly unequal even among those who weren't subject to enslavement. That, you know, the half the millionaires in America lived in one small town in the South. And, you know, it was, you know, enslavement was such a tool of enrichment, but such an unequal tool of enrichment.
Oh, absolutely.
That, you know, maintaining it required convincing people who didn't benefit from the system that they were somehow its beneficiaries. And I think that, you know, in that Margaret Atwoodian Handmaid's Tale way, you see how if you can construct a pyramid of steep enough sides where the rung below you is terrible enough, you can convince the people who are on rungs that aren't the top rungs, on levels that aren't the top level, that being on that level is good enough because it's so much better than being on the level below it.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that there is a kind of a society-wide Stockholm syndrome where, you know, if you're not at the very, very bottom, you start to identify with the people at the very, very top. And, you know, that becomes kind of a vicious circle.
That's Steinbeck and his temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right. Corey, I like to sort of take a little step to the side. And if you remember when I reached out to you, we're going to feature in this series of podcasts a little segment called Tell Us a Story, where we invite people to tell us a story. It can be from their own life, made up, partly made up, someone else's life. And if you could tell us one for a few minutes, I know that everyone would be really happy. And nobody write it down. This is Corey.
Oh, no, I've written it down too. Ideas are easy, execution is hard. So I'll tell you the story of one of my scariest parenting moments. So we live in Burbank, California, which is, you know, made famous by Johnny Carson and Laugh-In, beautiful downtown Burbank. It's a little town, 100,000 people, right on the edge of Hollywood, but its own political unit. It's as if like North York abutted, you know, Bloor Street or something. And it's remarkably well managed. It's a sweet little city. And it's a company town. It was Lockheed's base of operations for a long time, but it was also where the studios were. Yep. From my front door, I can walk to Disney, Warner, or Universal in about 20 minutes. And it's where the skilled trades have historically lived. So the talent lived over the hills in Hollywood, but the trades lived here. It's got a very high level of unionization between Lockheed and the trades. We've got 20 union halls down Burbank Boulevard. No exaggeration. And one of the cool things about living in a company town is that in the 50s and 60s, they shot a lot of Westerns and they cleared a bunch of Burbank and turned it into an equestrian district. And Burbank is a city where normal middle-class kids walk to the stables after school and shovel horse shit and curry horses and learn to ride in a way that like is unimaginable in a major metro anywhere else in the world. So our daughter, who's in middle school, walks over every couple of days. Back before the plague, she would walk over to the barn, sometimes every day. And, you know, she's got a mobile phone because it's 2020, and she sets the, like, follow my location on my phone bit before she goes and sends us a text. And, you know, we check in, make sure she gets there. We give her a call when it's getting to be dinner time, and we go and pick her up, and everything's fine. So one day, it was getting to be dinner time, and I sent her a text and she didn't answer. And I just went back to work. And then I realized a few minutes had gone by and she hadn't answered. So I gave her a call and she didn't answer. And my wife came in and said, "Where's the kid?" And I said, "I don't know. She's not answering her phone." She said, "Well, let me check her phone's location." And her phone was 16 miles from the barn on a freeway on ramp.
Oh, my God.
And we called the office of the barn. The office, they ride until 8 p.m., you know, they have big Klieg lights. But the barn closes at 6. The office closes at 6, so no one's answering. Call all of her friends. They've all gone home. We are starting to really seriously freak out. My wife jumps in the car and starts driving towards this freeway off-ramp in the middle of the San Fernando Valley. And I get on the phone with the sheriff's office. And I am frantically texting her friends. My wife is fighting traffic in tears, rush hour LA traffic. And I'm like through to the sheriff's office and talking to them when my call waiting beeps and it's my daughter calling. And I pick up the phone and she says, "What's going on? One of my friends just called my riding instructor because they had her cell phone number and everyone's freaking out. I'm just here at the barn. I'd taken my phone out of my pocket when I rode. I left it in my bag." And I was like, "What is going on?" Because her phone still said it was in the middle of this freeway on ramp. And I'll tell you what happened, which is that the way that phones derive their location is multifaceted. They have GPS, they have cell towers, right, they have IP address, and they have things like nearby Wi-Fi networks. And the way that those Find My Phone things work is they when you say, "Where is this phone at?" it pings the phone and it asks it, "Where are you?" But if the phone is not reachable, if, for example, you're in the middle of this ranch in Burbank where there's spotty cellular service, it just goes, when was the last time I saw this phone and what was its IP address? Now, the carrier that assigned that IP address doesn't geolocate the IP address. It is an IP address pool that is allocated to a 60-mile radius in our part of the San Fernando Valley. And when you ask where that IP address is, it drops a pin in the middle of it. And that's what was going on. And the thing is, it's a little parable, and it's a parable about the problem with systems, not that work badly, but that work well, but don't tell you when they fail. Because the reason we trusted it is it had never given us a bum steer.
Right.
If it was erratic, we would have just gone, oh, she's at the barn. What the heck's going on, right? It's because this failure mode comes up erratically, and because the where is this phone, share my location thing does not distinguish between I contacted the phone, ask it where it was, it got a GPS fix and told me, and I contacted the phone, couldn't find it, asked where its last IP address was, and then I asked the phone company where that IP address was geolocated, and it gave me the pin in the middle of its location. Those two pieces of information are presented identically.
Right.
And you know, it's a parable with some like important lessons for us, because if there is an anti-fraud algorithm that mostly catches fraud but sometimes gets a dolphin in the tuna net, or if there's a hiring algorithm that mostly recommends good candidates and rejects bad candidates but occasionally swaps that, then the fact that it works is the thing that will confound you, not the fact that it fails. And it was the worst hour of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can imagine that this, you know, could happen to police when they're using the same technology for an investigation.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. And also, you know, so much of what we think of as forensic science is forensic phrenology, you know, whether it's lie detectors or a lot of genetic tests and so on. And, you know, you see this with expert testimony about things like bites, where they come in and they say, oh, these bite marks, I can tell you with a high degree of conclusiveness, came from this perpetrator, this defendant. And, you know, it's not great science.
Right.
But oftentimes either like there's no penalty for getting it wrong because the cops are sure they've got the right person, or the cops do have the right person.
Right.
And so you never know whether the evidence is wrong.
Or gate identification in the Little Brothers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. That's the thing. You know, you look at predictive policing tools, Predpol and some of the surveillance things like Palantir, you know, it's basically totalitarianism as a service. And, you know, they don't have to like identify the right people to, you know, for dictators to arrest and attach electrodes to their testicles, right? Dictators just want to arrest a kind of like steady drumbeat of people and subject their genitals to electrocution,
right.
You know, pour encourager les autres, right? And like they don't, they, you know, like you don't have to identify witches.
Yep.
For witches to be burned. You just have to identify someone who doesn't get to complain for witches to be burned.
Right. I've always thought that the guiding principles in penology among ordinary people who really want severe penalties is it's not because of a desire for justice, but they're angry and they'd really like to hurt someone.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the same reason that when you spill your coffee, you smash the mug.
Right.
It's not the mug's fault.
That's exactly right. Well, thank you for that story, which I think is a lesson to the wise. And that actually kind of moves into the next thing I wanted to talk with you about, your voice and the issues that you're engaged with around creating a more free, just, and equitable digital landscape. That clearly introduces an element of polemicism into your fiction. But we also live in a very, I think it's safe to say, propaganda-rich environment all across the spectrum. No matter where you sit on any political issue, there's some propaganda just for you. And so as a person with a sense of responsibility, how do you draw the line between, you know, where you set the limits and where the polemical elements end and, you know, not moving into the propaganda sphere begins?
Well, I think you have to be honest, right? I mean, that's the difference, I think, between propaganda. And obviously honesty is like a spectrum because, you know, there are always facts that get counted in and facts that get counted out and things that are made salient and things that are dismissed as an irrelevance. And I guess that you try to be honest in the sense of being an honest broker, right? You try not to mislead, and you try to illuminate. And illuminating sometimes means omissions, right? There's this critique of headlines that says that they're clickbait if they omit any salient facts. But if the story is at all significant, there will be more salient facts than can fit in the headline, right? That's why we have articles. And the point of the headline is to make you interested. Now, it's one thing to omit a fact that reveals that the headline was unimportant, right? I read a very long article on a website that's otherwise very good, I think just this morning, it might have been yesterday, about a poker cheating scandal. And the headline in the opening section made it sound like we were about to find out that someone who was a champion poker player had been cheating through some nefarious means. And what we actually find out by the end is that they were accused by cheating and no one knows if they did it. And, you know, I felt cheated, right? Yeah. I felt like there is a headline, you know, there's Betteridge's law. Any headline that ends in a question mark, the answer is no, but there is room for a question mark in a headline, which is like, is so-and-so a cheater?
Right.
That would have been a good headline. I would have read it, and I would have read it especially if the first paragraph had said, so-and-so plays in this way that is both flawless and inexplicable. It is hard to imagine that they could do without cheating, but no one knows if they're doing it. Read on for the saga of the personalities and the fights. But to have set me up on a 10,000-word article for the idea that I was going to get to the end and find out about some delicious chicanery,
yes,
right, or some crazy skullduggery, right? Like something super banal, like they thought of everything, but they never thought he might have a mirror in his shoe, you know, like you know, a kind of comeuppance story about the blindness that we have. But to get to the end and say nobody knows,
right,
felt like a cheat. So I'm all for headlines that omit key details, provided they don't mislead in that way.
Right.
And so that's what being an honest broker is. It's the expectation that once the reader knows what you do, they won't feel like you have led them astray.
Right. And I think one other thing about real propaganda is it only works if it's invisible, right? If you know that, you know, someone is trying to change your perception of reality, you're on your guard. You don't fall for it.
Yeah.
And I think in the world of fiction, even with a relatively invisible narrative voice behind it, people do know, and I think they have the tools to evaluate.
Well, this is a subject that I've been spending a lot of time writing and talking about because of the epistemological crisis that we're mired in about, you know, not like people think that we have an argument about what is true, and what we actually have an argument about is how you know whether something is true, yep, right? Like a good debater's tactic is to ask your adversary, what could I tell you to change your mind? What proof would change your mind? And if you do that with people who believe in QAnon or anti-vax or, you know, other conspiratorial forms of thinking, what you'll find is that the things that they think of as the gold standard for proof are not the things that you think of, and that they have often not terrible reasons,
yep,
for mistrusting the things that you think are good ways to know the truth, right? That they think that the reason you can't trust the companies that make vaccines is because pharmaceutical companies come from this super concentrated industry, which is willing to kill people for a buck, and that their regulators let them get away with it. They're not wrong, right? Like that part's true,
yeah,
right? The Sacklers are richer than the Rockefellers, right? Like it's absolutely the case that the pharmaceutical industry kills people to make a buck. It's just not the case that vaccines aren't safe.
Right.
And so I think that to understand the prevalence of conspiratorial belief, you have to understand that it turns on like the intersection of material conditions. So people who have been traumatized by actual conspiracies, and conspiracy is just another word for corruption.
Yeah.
People who've been traumatized by conspiracy find it easier to believe in conspiracy because they have direct lived experience, sure, of it. So if you've lost a loved one to opioids, or if one of your relatives died on a 737 Max, or any of the other expressions of corruption that have killed so many of us, or, you know, if austerity left you and the people you love to starve or become homeless or any of those other things that emerge from corrupt rulemaking, corrupt lawmaking, corrupt governance, then you're willing to believe your material conditions have changed. That also being around other people who believe the same thing, people who can tell a good story, that's important too, right? And also that the trauma of having been wounded by conspiracy and being in trauma, having unreconciled trauma, makes it harder for you to think rationally.
Yeah.
Right. You know, in the same way that like when you stub your toe, it's hard to stop hopping around hollering, even though it's not going to help. You know, when you're hurting, it's hard to listen to reason. And we put a lot of emphasis on getting people to stop believing wrong things and start believing right things. But we really neglect making people less vulnerable to wrong things by putting our institutions to right so that SNC-Lavalin and We Charity and all of the other scandals that have ripped through us and shown us that the people who we deputize to act in the public interest throw the public interest away whenever it's inconvenient to hew to it.
Just to pick up on that point, I mean, in common parlance, conspiracy theory means, you know, a collusion of sinister forces. That's always not true, right? It's always a falsehood. Of course, you know, that suggests that there are not and never have been conspiracies. Tell that to Abraham Lincoln. So,
or the Tuskegee Airmen,
right?
Or any First Nations person whose ancestors signed a treaty.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. And I think that part of that, which veers off into, you know, certain social and political beliefs is, you know, you're quite right. There's a basis of pain and injury there. And I think one of the key factors is a loss of respect in society, right? You become the deplorable. Well, if I'm deplorable, then, you know, everything that you stand, you know, I reject that. And that makes you very open to alternative explanations, which unfortunately people can tend to grasp uncritically.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that that definitely, like, no one ever convinced anyone else by holding them in contempt.
Right.
Right. I mean, sometimes, you know, as someone who gets into online debates for tactical reasons to try and make change in the world, sometimes you argue with people you have no respect for, not because you hope to change their mind, but because you're playing to the gallery,
yes.
Right? You want the people who are on the sidelines to see that your arguments are better than their arguments. Sometimes you pick an interlocutor whose arguments are particularly bad because you know that you can make a good showing by doing that. And that is a way of winning over other people to your side. But you're right that, you know, you don't arrive at social consensus by telling people they're terrible. And, you know, the book I'm working on now, I'm writing a novel about truth and reconciliation after a successful Green New Deal. And it really tries to grapple with the question of what you do with people who have committed great wrongs, because if there is no way to be rehabilitated, then there is no reason to surrender, right? Like, one of the reasons we have prisoners of war regimes is not because we are merciful, but because we want the other side, when they're licked, to lay down their weapons and know that they'll be treated with dignity. Because if they know that if they lay down their weapons, they'll be shot, right, then they'll fight to the last, right? And so it's good for us to give our adversaries the promise of mercy and just treatment. And, you know, this is not to elevate the plight of the canceled over the people that they victimized, right? But it is to say that unless we figure out how we deal with people who are on the wrong side of a just revolution, that they will not dig holes, crawl in them, and pull the dirt in on top of them and vanish. That instead you will find, you know, Nazism festering in Bavaria, and you will find Hungarians who are still angry about the revolution, and you'll find Russians who are still angry about the Romanovs.
Yep.
Right? That in the absence of that reconciliation, the great scars never heal. I mean, I grew up going to Purim parties where whenever the name of the grand vizier, yeah, of a long dead Persian monarch was mentioned, we would swing a noisemaker. Talk about holding a goddamn grudge, you know?
Yeah.
Let go of it. It's been thousands of years. You know, if hate is when you drink poison and you expect your enemy to die, like, when can we stop?
Right, exactly.
You know?
But the pastries are good.
But the little triangular pastries are the bomb.
Right, exactly. Okay, so let me ask you about something else. So we're living in a world that where everyone's life is touched by information technology and computers and so on. It's our social relationships, our commercial relationships, our romantic relationships, everything. And largely we're affected in ways for the average person that isn't visible to them. And I think it's also safe to say that there's a divide between those who are content to just enjoy the benefits and, you know, of everything from Facebook to one-click shopping, and those who really have been deeply engaged for years and trying to sound the alarm when things are going in the wrong direction and push hard to make them go in the right. But for those who engage at the level of the consumer rather than the citizen, if I can use that analogy,
sure.
You know, how do we make them aware of how bad things are? How bad are they, I guess? Mm-hmm. And at least get them to take it seriously, to get them to move from the level of abstraction about things like privacy or what you're allowed to do or what could actually make you a criminal under, you know, digital rights management regimes, and to move it from abstraction to something that they understand viscerally.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is not unique to technology. I think it's a common factor in lots of technical policy questions, especially ones where cause and effect are separated by a lot of time and space, right? It's very hard to, you know, even without denial, it's very hard to understand the relationship of action to climate change, because we are currently experiencing the climate consequences of things that happened 30 years ago. And it's the people 30 years from now who are going to experience the consequences of our own tailpipe emissions. And in that world, right, where you wind up and swing at the ball, but you don't find out for 30 years whether you hit, it's hard to get better at aiming at the ball. And then you add to that all of the expensively sown doubt, and, you know, where there is a parochial interest in denying that causal relationship, it's really hard to make the connection. And, you know, it's my friend Tim Harford, who's a statistician and broadcaster in the UK, has a new book coming out where he talks about how the author of the very famous book, How to Lie with Statistics, became a shill for the tobacco industry.
Oh.
What he did was he went around and he said, oh, sure, they show you there's a statistical correlation with between tobacco and cancer, but everyone knows that you can lie with statistics.
Right.
I wrote the book on it. I should know. And in fact, the follow-up to How to Lie with Statistics, which was never published, was called How to Lie with Smoking Statistics. And so it is very hard to get good at that stuff. And the problem is that although there is a moment at which it is undeniable that that something is going on, right? Like if you smoke long enough, you'll get lung cancer. It's too late. Right. The moment to actually, you know, Oppenheimer was eventually going to realize that nuclear weapons were a bad idea. Unfortunately, it took until after he built one for him to figure it out.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if only he'd started quoting from the Bhagavad Gita a little earlier, maybe we wouldn't have spent, you know, 60, 75 years living under the shadow of nuclear Armageddon.
Right.
So I think that the way that you create early onset Oppenheimers is with storytelling. You know, to get people to viscerally experience the long-term consequences, you invoke the cognitive illusion that is in all fiction, that you can have empathy for an imaginary person, that you can know what another person is thinking, something that no human being has ever done. In the history of our human race, no one's ever gotten outside of the bone box that encompasses their brain and found out what was happening inside of someone else's bone box ever, and no one probably ever will. But all fiction has that pretense that you can know what someone else is thinking. And you invoke that cognitive illusion, that empathic illusion that causes people to feel empathy for people living through imaginary circumstances, and you tell them the story of what it might be like to live through the consequences that are down the way. And that is the most reliable way we know, right? The silent spring way of getting people to start to take this stuff seriously before it reaches the point of no return, you know, to do what Helen Caldicott did in her NFB movie, If You Love This Planet, and make us think about what nuclear war meant
right. Before
we lived through one, or at least before we'd lived through an all-out one. Obviously, people in Japan lived through one.
Yes.
You know.
If you can live it vicariously. It really disarms the impulse to say, this is too great, too overwhelming. I want to put my head in the sands. I just want to deny and retreat, which actually brings us to this. Everyone should actually read The Little Brothers. Well, it's about to be a trilogy. This is actually a duology in a bit, because there's a little snippet in this edition, and a very lovely introduction by Edward Snowden as well, which is very nice. But although it is technically, I think this is a bookseller bigotry, young adult fiction. It's been a long time since I was a young adult. I enjoyed it immensely. I also learned a lot about technology. But it is ripping good fiction, but it carries quite a punch. And I think it's really a great illustration of exactly what you're talking about. You know, but it also describes how bad can it be. And I take it that, you know, it's really that bad, isn't it?
I think that we are living through a golden age of turnkey surveillance and control, that for reasons that I still struggle with, people who, like me, had the near mystical experience of sitting down at a computer and getting it to do what you told it to do, finding yourself on a network and connecting with people like-minded all around the world, or people who had ideas that you have never encountered where you were, and having your mind opened, that those people have devoted their lives and their hard-won skill to taking away other people's ability to live those experiences. And, you know, Attack Surface, the third one, which is not a young adult novel, it's a standalone novel for adults, I should point out, although young adult novel really is something between a set of genre conventions and a set of promises, implicit promises to librarians and teachers that you won't cost them their jobs. Right. It's certainly not exclusive. It's like, it can be enjoyed safely by young adults, not must be only enjoyed by young adults. Yeah. But this is a standalone novel for adults, and not because it deals with a lot of bathing suit area stuff, but because it's about a moral reckoning. It's about a woman who spends her whole life engaged with some of the thorniest technology problems that we have, building really high grade technology that she talks herself into thinking should exist in the world, even though it exists mostly to hunt people who have no social power and put them in a world of hurt, whether that's working for the Department of Homeland Security or fighting insurgents in Iraq with a military contractor, or finding herself in the former Soviet Union working for a thinly veiled version of the NSO group, who, you know, which is partly owned by a Canadian billionaire, is the arms dealer of choice to the world's most despotic, torturing, murdering thugs. It's the tools that were used to entrap Jamal Khashoggi and to attack Jeff Bezos, you know? Yeah. And so she has to figure out what her life's work means, and she has to figure it out quick, because her moral ambivalence has led her to get fired and to have to leave the ex-Soviet republic that she's been working in very quickly.
Right.
And she finds herself back in San Francisco, where her childhood best friend is now a Black Lives Matter activist, and she is being targeted by exactly the same cyber weapons that this protagonist spent her whole life building. And the war has come home, right? In the same way that for a lot of soldiers who were serving in Kandahar, they come home and they see cops wearing the same body armor and carrying the same anti-personnel weapons. Yes. That they use there. Also happened with Vietnam War veterans, and happens whenever we go to war. The things we do to the people we dehumanize in other countries, we bring back and do to the people who have the least respect and humanity in our own. You know, this is a book that is like Little Brother, part of the moral education of technologists. I have lost count of the number, dozens, if not hundreds, of technologists, cyber lawyers, security researchers, human rights activists, cryptographers, who tell me that the reason that they got involved was they read Little Brother, and it made them want to revisit the ethical dimension of their work, and to make their life's work building technology that enhanced human thriving. And this is a book that speaks to the people who found themselves inside the system year after year, making compromise after compromise, first a small one and then a larger one and then a larger one still, until they found themselves in this stepwise fashion, one grain of rice at a time, shouldering a moral burden that they can no longer carry, and to show them a way to address that moral debt and to refocus their technological work on giving people more self-determination and to making the world a fairer place rather than taking it away from them.
Right. Well, you know, the human power to rationalize is almost unlimited, but some people run out of it a little sooner than others. And I guess those are the ones who find themselves in a bit of a moral dilemma. Corey, you're being very generous with your time. I just have a couple more questions, if you can bear with me for that. So I think even today, a lot of people don't know about digital rights management fully, how pervasive it is. I mean, essentially, from some of the descriptions, it has the potential to make criminals of virtually all of us in one way or another. Can you give us a report from the front?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're familiar with digital rights management, it's probably through something like, you know, bringing a DVD home from overseas and having it refuse to play in your DVD player, or having a video game that won't run on a certain console, or, you know, maybe if you've been paying attention, you've heard stories about farmers who aren't allowed to fix their own tractors anymore. And if they try, they get locked out by technology. And digital rights management is it's processes that run in computers, whether those computers are embedded in devices or you know, are in our phones or are in our thermostats or in our cars. And they attempt to thwart the owner of the device's interests. So when you try to do something, the device says no. And they are not, as a technical matter, all that hard to remove, because they are fundamentally a secret program running on a computer that is in your hands. And maybe you don't know how to interrogate that computer and find the secret programs on it, but someone does, right? And once they find it, they can tell you how to fix it. And so very early in the history of digital rights management, in 1998, the U.S. Congress adopted a law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And Section 1201 of that law makes it a felony to remove DRM, to tell people how to remove it, to make a tool to remove it. And not a little one, 5-year prison sentence, a $500,000 fine for a first offense, right? And very importantly, the U.S. Congress did not tie these penalties to acts of copyright infringement. So if you think back on bringing home a DVD from, say, Mexico or India or even the UK, buying a DVD in a shop that is a licensed DVD that has been sold by the manufacturer at the price the manufacturer specified, and bringing it home and watching it, is not a copyright infringement. No. It is the actual, like, non-hyperbolic opposite of a copyright infringement. It's what copyright's supposed to enable. I bought it, I can enjoy it, right? And what it is it's a system for allowing manufacturers who can find a way to integrate a copyright lock into their device to felonize conduct that displeases their shareholders. If you design a device so that using it in ways that benefit you at the expense of the manufacturer first requires that you remove some DRM, then anything you do that displeases the shareholders becomes a felony contempt of business model. And that was at first a kind of latent threat, to go back to, you know, by the time it's present, it's maybe too late. It was a latent threat because putting software in devices was hard, because computers were expensive in the late 90s.
Right.
In fact, you know, a company that was a division of IBM, Lexmark, which makes printers, they sued a Taiwanese company that was refilling its toner cartridges. They were charging more for powdered carbon than you would pay for the same carbon in diamond form, you know. And to remanufacture these cartridges, they had to reverse engineer the little chip that said, you know, all my carbon is gone, don't use me anymore, and make it say, I'm now full. And they went to the court because Lexmark sued them, and the court said, what copyrighted work does this DRM defend? And they said, oh, it's the program in the chip. And the court said, but the program is only 12 bytes long. It's not even a haiku. It doesn't rise to the level of copyrightability. So there is no copyright lock. This is just a lock. It's not a copyright lock. But since then, every device has got unambiguously copyrightable works in it, because the 22-cent system on a chip you buy in a gross lot from AliExpress has got a whole copy of Linux on it, right? With, you know, like tens of thousands of lines of code. It is clearly copyrightable. And when they stick it in your light bulb, using that light bulb in a socket that the manufacturer didn't approve becomes a felony if you tamper with it to make it work, if the manufacturer has decided that you're not allowed to do it. And so we've arrived at this moment in which devices as varied as insulin pumps and glucose monitors, tractors, ventilators, cars, car parts, individual engine parts, and so on, have all just enough DRM to make it a felony to use them in ways that benefit you instead of the manufacturers. And this has some knock-on effects. So not only does this fence off competitors, right? Because like in a real market economy, you would expect that, you know, as happened with Lexmark, if you're charging more for powdered carbon than you would pay for diamonds, someone will come along and be willing to charge less. So it lets you control those competitors and prevent them from competing with you. And it also lets you to control your customers. But lastly, it lets you control your critics. Because if I'm a security researcher who discovers a defect in your device, a defect that might expose that customer to enormous risk. You know, we've seen wireless defects in insulin pumps that allow attackers to remotely like dump all of the insulin in your pump, in your bloodstream, and kill you in your boots. Exposing that vulnerability, if it means exposing a vulnerability in the DRM, becomes also a crime. And so now you see critics and customers and competitors all being put under the thumb of dominant firms. And, you know, what dominant firm wouldn't welcome the chance to do it? And so they're all busily retooling to find new and better ways to conjure felonies out of thin air, to create a system of private laws. And, you know, as an author, this does me no good. You know, you mentioned that there's this Kickstarter for the Attack Surface audiobook. You know, I won't let my work be published with DRM. And thankfully, at least for ebooks, it's a choice, you know, Amazon and Kobo and all the other ones. They let you choose whether you want DRM. But with audiobooks, which is a market that Amazon controls 90% of through their Audible division, it's DRM or nothing. And because I refuse the DRM, my publishers are like, you know, we respect your position, but if you're going to prevent us from selling this into the channel that controls 90% of the market, we're just not going to pay you for those rights. You can retain them. So, you know, luckily, there's been so much disaggregation in publishing that I got to hire the same studio my publishers use and the same voice actors, the same directors. You know, I happen to live around the corner from this great audiobook studio, Skyboat Media, or one of the titans in the field. And around the other corner is Amber Benson from Buffy, Tara, who's also a great novelist, but a spectacular voice actor. And, you know, I was able to make this incredible, unabridged 15-hour audiobook of it. And I've done this before and I just sell it on my website. But this time I was like, you know what? If I could prove that you can be a successful independent audiobook publisher, if you're a successful writer already, right? If you're a bestseller, you don't need Amazon to clean up like crazy as an audiobook publisher. Then other best-selling authors might come along with it, not because they care about Amazon's monopoly, although maybe they are feeling a little diseased about this, but just because money talks and bullshit walks. And you know, publishers might say, hey, we want a piece of this too. We'll do the production and help you with the Kickstarter marketing if we can get a share of this too. And if that happens, then Amazon becomes not the place where all the bestsellers are, but the place where none of the bestsellers are.
Right.
And when that happens, they have to deal, because that's the one point at which the monopoly starts to falter, right? And, you know, the thing is that content delivery, like sending someone a digital file, is a commodity service. There is not any difference to the experience of downloading the audiobook from me to downloading it from Amazon once you've set it up an account with me, right? There's that little bit of friction. Once it's done, it's done. And if we let Libro.fm and even Google Play, which has a no DRM option, and all of the other publishers, Downpour and so on, the retail platforms, sell our audiobooks, but not Audible, and people start to defect from subscribing to Audible to creating monthly recurring subscriptions with these rivals, which have the same catalog, except more bestsellers if I'm successful, then Amazon will finally come to the table and deal. And, you know, I'm often very skeptical of accounts, the kind of neoliberal account that locates all systemic problem solutions with individual action. You know, just recycle harder if you're worried about climate change. You know, if you don't like monopoly capitalism, shop somewhere else. You know, obviously this is a ridiculous idea.
Yeah, right.
Right.
For what?
But yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe let me explain the word monopoly using smaller words. Yeah. But this is an instance in which a pebble can start an avalanche and change the face of the mountain. It may not work. It's a long shot. And even if it does, it's not going to make Amazon not a monopolist. But it will erode the excessive buying power monopoly a little bit at the margin and give some inertia to this building movement to fight monopolies everywhere that is not limited to a tech monopoly movement. You know, in a world with five movie studios and four publishers and three record labels and two beer companies and one eyewear manufacturer dominating each of those industries, there is so much energy and room for people to come together to fight monopolies.
And so much anger and frustration. But
yeah,
it's an interesting, and I don't want to use a counterfactual that's discouraging, but you know, one of the most striking episodes in a book from my growing up has to do with the industry that I used to be part of, the record business, a book called Hitmen.
Sure, I know that book. Yep.
And of course it talks about the attempt by Columbia Records to break the Payola scam by saying that, you know, when Pink Floyd's The Wall was the biggest record ever and they were coming to LA to tour, CBS said, no payola. And they said, it's so powerful a hit that no radio station that wants to keep its audience would dare keep it off the air. But, you know, for the weeks leading up to their arrival in LA, it was absolutely blacklisted from airplay. I'm not saying that I want this to happen again in this
case,
but, you know, it's going to be a real epic struggle for sure.
But here's the contrafactual, the right contrafactual, is if in that world, the low-power FM stations broadcasting 1 watt could be listened to by everyone in Southern California, and they could play The Wall, right? Then the dominant firms would have had to buckle.
Yep.
Because what they were able to do was say all or nothing, right? You give us payola or no one hears Pink Floyd. But if it was you give us payola or everyone hears Pink Floyd, just not on our channel.
Right.
That would have made all the difference. And this is where we have some escape valves. And I'm not saying history runs on rails, and I'm not saying that this will automatically work. I am saying that I've got $225,000 worth of backers and 15 days to go, and it's a bestseller.
Which is fantastic. And your target on the campaign was?
The target was only $7,000, which is like what it cost me to do the legwork to set it up.
Please repeat. Target $7,000, currently standing at?
Almost 230. Okay. Yeah. So that's a good number, right? Absolutely. Yeah. But what I really want, and I'm still not there. I have 5,000 backers. I want 10,000. In fact, I really want 20,000. 20,000. If the cynics in the industry say, well, he got 20,000, half of them won't stick to your fingers. If you did it a second time, the novelty will have worn off. 10,000 still makes a bestseller.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. So 20,000 would be a good number. 10,000 is still a good number, but it won't convince the cynics, but it might convince the optimists.
Okay. You freedom fighters out there, you know where to go. You know, I feel a little Michael Moore-ish about, you know, doing the rally.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, and, you know, just to sort of back away from DRM, I mean, this is part of a much larger web of copyright enhancement and, you know, ludicrous levels of patent liberalization and the international treaty enforcement and finding intellectual property laws that are so distasteful that you end up, you know, planting the seed in a different country through lobbying, and then, you know, it becomes acceptable to import it, all of that kind of stuff, which taken as a whole, you know, is a monumental step back to Rentierism.
Sure.
Which, you know, oddly enough, is the most anti-capitalistic thing there is, because Adam Smith's whole thesis was based on the idea that we had, you know, that
euthanize rentiers.
Right, exactly. Industrial capitalism was the solution to rentierism. So anyway, with all of the stand you're taking, the people you work with, also some of the sadly tragic experiences that you've dealt with, you know, have you ever felt personally at risk?
No, you know, I take the same precautions that I think anyone who does online stuff tries to take, which is to be very private about my home address, which is ridiculously hard because there are a lot of things where you have to list it. You know, I just renewed my daughter's passport and I had to, like, her Canadian passport, and the Canadian government doesn't want the private mailbox. They want to know where we live for reasons that still baffle me. Right. But, you know, and like, if the NSA and the CSIS can't keep their secrets from leaking, is the passport office going to do any better? Right. But that said, I am a middle-class English-speaking white dude who works for an impact litigator with like rabid attack lawyers. So I have been thus far okay. You know, I have the shield of privilege.
But Aaron Swartz arguably would. In a similar, and that's a real tragedy and a real outrage.
Aaron had more tolerance for risk than I did. I do a lot less direct action than he does. And it's, you know, in some ways it's because of my early work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. When I started working with them 20 years ago, I really internalized EFF's theory of change, which is that if we're the defendants, we can't be the lawyers. Right. And the way that we change the law is by being the lawyers. We find, you know, this is how impact litigation works. You find good cases and you make good laws. The opposite of hard cases making good law. You make good cases into good law and you overturn bad laws. And it's a highly leveraged activity, right? It's a thing where you can take on vast industries, huge, all-powerful government agencies, and use the constitutionalism and the independent judiciary to thwart all of their lobbying, all of their might, and just you know, neutralize them.
Right.
And so that's an amazing, powerful thing to do, but it only works if you're not the ones charged.
Yeah. You said independent judiciary. You've heard of the Federalist Society, I take it.
I have. And, you know, it's true, but there is a funny equilibrium in the judiciary, which is that it derives its power from its legitimacy. And historically, when the judiciary was at odds with the norms, right, the bench is just it's got a consequentialist streak running through it, because it has to, because when the norms and the law are out of step, it is easy for politicians to sideline judges. When the norms and the law are in step, politicians who sideline judges sound like dictators. But, you know, Lincoln inherited the Dred Scott Supreme Court,
right?
The Supreme Court that said that the white society owes the black man no justice. And Lincoln campaigned by saying the Supreme Court is an illegitimate institution that we will sideline if I am elected. And when he was elected, his inaugural speech said the Supreme Court has passed any number of unjust rulings and we will operate as though they were never passed down, and we will enact laws that violate the Supreme Court's rulings and dare them to come after us. And judges understand this. And so even though it's an imperfect system, the equilibrium that you get with the judiciary, even the Federalist Society and its textualism, is still oriented around norm respecting, around being in step. And whether it's FDR threatening to pack the courts or Lincoln sidelining the courts, the judges protect their legitimacy even when it runs counter to their own view of the law, because it's sort of better to be a live mouse than a dead rat. They want to survive to fight another day. They want their legacy to be not the legacy of Lincoln's Supreme Court, which is that no one called on them for 10 years after Lincoln took office. They were irrelevant to the American system.
Right.
Reconstruction proceeded without the Supreme Court getting a look. They want to have their legacy defined by their relevance, and they can only do that if they approach some equilibrium. So anyway, you know, the other thing about Aaron is that he was a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
And almost my entire activist career has been while I was an immigrant, first in the UK and then in the US. And I don't have rights.
Yeah.
You know, and so the civil disobedience has a completely different character. When I was a Canadian, I got arrested. I got arrested blockading arms bazaars in Ottawa. I got arrested blockading nuclear plants in Pickering and Darlington. You know, it was fine. I was a kid too, so I was a young offender. I knew my record would be purged. But the price is much higher when you face deportation.
Yes.
Especially, you know, if you've got a house and a family and all the rest of it.
Exactly. Although, obviously, I think he must have been absolutely shocked at how serious. I mean, he was essentially hounded to death over what arguably was an extremely innocuous action.
I think a benign one, you know, downloading public domain and or publicly produced scientific articles. But the thing about Aaron, I think, is that he learned the wrong lesson. So he had previously been involved in another mass downloading effort that had attracted legal scrutiny when he and some friends found that the library system had a pilot program that gave them free access to the otherwise paywalled American judicial records through a system called Pacer. And they wrote a scraper that they ran from library computers that downloaded $1 million worth of public domain records, and they released them to the public. So the public didn't have to pay for them anymore.
And they didn't have to pay for what was theirs to begin with.
For what was theirs to begin with, for the law. I mean, right. the bedrock principle of like us of the law is that if you can't read the law, it's not the law. And a bedrock duty of the state is to make the law available to the people who are expected to obey it, yep. Right? So Aaron did this, and among other things, like, he did frustrate them by taking $1 million worth of the stuff that they were making rents off of and using not to pay for the service as they were mandated to, but instead to, like, buy video systems for courtrooms and stuff. But also, he revealed what identity thieves and criminals had known all along, which is that the court clerks were not redacting the court records, that you could find in them tax IDs of hacking victims or financial fraud victims, the home addresses of stalking survivors, true names of minors who had either been tried with crimes or been victimized by crime. And when they revealed this, the FBI came after them. So they called up the DOJ and they said, you know, guys, you should know your court clerks are asleep at the switch. And rather than thanking them, they tried to find a reason to arrest them and failed because what they did was legal and legitimate. And I think Aaron was emboldened by it. And I think that he felt the invulnerability of adolescence and the righteousness of someone who knows that he's right and the false sense of invulnerability of someone who's grown up with a lot of privilege and the stubbornness of someone who can't tolerate injustice. And he refused to back down. And, you know, he could have taken a plea. He could have gone to jail for a very short time,
right.
But he wouldn't do it. And he wouldn't do it in part because he didn't want to be a felon and he wanted to stand for office eventually, I think. I don't know that for sure, but I think that. But also because it was the wrong thing to do. And he was committed to justice. He just didn't want to cave in on a matter of principle because principle mattered to him.
Yeah.
He was stubborn. Yep.
I'm going to ask a stupid question, but I have a point in asking it. Where's the bigger threat in terms of, you know, freedom in the information world, from government or corporations?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, I think there's been a fusion.
Yeah.
You know, that we hope that the equilibrium that states and firms come to is that the states stop the firms from overreaching and the firms stop the states from overreaching. And instead, we see this merger, and some of it is like microeconomic, right? You have hyper-concentrated industries who are the only people qualified to regulate them come from their own C-suites. So they rotate into government roles, they rotate back out again. And you see that, you know, if you look into any MP who's passed a law you hated, and then you go look at their Wikipedia entry, chances are they're now working for the industry that benefited from that law. But also, you see it at an industrial scale and at a ministerial scale, where the way that the security services are able to wiretap the nation is not by building their own equipment, but rather by commandeering the surveillance data that is generated by private firms that want to spy on you to sell you more fidget spinners.
Right.
And, you know, I often get this. So when I go and talk in Silicon Valley, you know, they're like, well, I'm fine with Google spying on me. They just want to make the products better. They're smart people. I see them at the squash courts. But, you know, the NSA, those are the people who are too stupid to get jobs in Silicon Valley. They're all like, you know, delusional secret squirrels, right? I don't want those guys having my stuff, those govies. And when I'm inside the Beltway or when I give a talk at West Point or whatever, they say to me, well, you know, Uncle Sam knows everything about me. I'm in the service, right? I have top secret clearance. I had to tell the Office of Personnel Management all potential sources of compromise on me. They know about my mom's heroin habit. They know my brother's gay and in the closet, all of it. I had to do it on, you know, pain of serious jailable penalties down the line if I'd made any material omissions. But Google, those guys, you know, would sell their mother for a nickel, right? And what they fail to appreciate is the reason Google operates with impunity, the reason, for example, we don't have a federal privacy statute with a private right of action in the U.S. is because the federal government can't muster the political will because they need Google intact to help them with their spying projects. And, you know, when the DOJ was ready to break up AT&T in the 50s, after decades of consent decrees and conduct remedies that were supposed to make a cleanup of its act, none of which ever did, because after all, a fine is always a price. Finally, the conduct of AT&T grew so odious that they were ready to break them up. And the Pentagon intervened and they said, we will never win the war in Korea unless AT&T is intact, right? You know, the fusion of the state and industry gives industry stakeholders within the state and gives the state stakeholders within industry. What's good for GM is good for America. And AT&T got a 30-year stay of execution. And those 30 years were not pretty, right? AT&T did not have a deathbed conversion And like, it wasn't Scrooge on Christmas morning, yeah. right? You know, vowing to live its life a better way. The lesson they took from their reprieve was that if you are going to be corrupt, at least make accomplices of the government.
Right, right.
So, and, you know, the Snowden leaks revealed that AT&T was their number one partner in illegal spying.
In every respect, it's just an extension of the military-industrial complex. This convergence of very lucrative industries with, you know, government functions, and ultimately the citizen pays the price at a certain point. You know, the word innovation is probably now the second most used word in the lexicon after, I don't know, sneeze.
Disruption.
Disruption, yes, exactly. Disruptive innovation. There we go. But at a certain point, it seems to me that there's a new bottles, old wine aspect, because certain fundamental principles like, you know, concentration of power, creation of monopolies, concentration of wealth, and in many ways, the liberating potential of technology also has very real precedence. I mean, you know, 500 years ago, it's actually just past 500 years ago, Martin Luther unseated a 700-year-old geopolitical order with a single document and a bunch of Gutenberg presses and a few activists who spread that around Europe. And, you know, they fell like dominoes. So isn't really incumbent upon us to keep learning from the past, because there are these rebounds that kind of can give us some extra arrows in our strategic quivers, and strategy is really crucial.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, it can historical analogies can mislead, and there's always you can always find one that supports your thesis, whatever it is. You know, this is Rome. No, it's Greece. No, it's, you know, like whatever, right? But I think that you're right that the study of history and the study of technological change reveals an awful lot. And you know, when we talk about Martin Luther, we do emphasize the technology. What we, I think, probably fail to emphasize is the material conditions, right? The reason people were ready to have Luther's revolution was in part because of the manifest injustice of the church and the increasing thinness of the story of the divine right of kings, right? Of the idea that some were born to rule. And as that grew thinner through a bunch of different factors, some of which were normative, some of which were technologically determined, you know, the rise of artisans and so on, some social mobility, the, you know, enclosure and so on. As all of that happened, you got changes. They're hard to all tease apart. But we do live in a moment of where material conditions are ripe for explanations that call for an overturning of the old order. Right. The old order is just not working for most people. The temporarily embarrassed millionaires are starting to wonder whether or not they're ever going to get a check. And I think, you know, coronavirus has really made it clear that the story that everyone's got a chance, we're all in this together, that is not the case.
There are mass consciousness tipping points for sure. And I think even before coronavirus, certain things that were unthinkable, like a lot of people in America would demand public health care, or, you know, there would be a real mass movement behind saving the environment and, you know, saving all of our lives and futures and those of every other living thing on the planet. That seemed unattainable. And yet here we are. And those ranks are growing. And I think, you know, clearly old farts like me need to die off because, you know, it's very demographically defined.
You know, sometimes when you're fighting an adversary, that you see that they respond to even the most minor provocation with an all-out blitz of force. And it can seem like if they have so much ammo to burn, they must have an infinite supply. They must be at the peak of their power. But it's hard to know, because the other entity that fights like that, that greets even the smallest transgression with an all-out response, is the one that's fighting for its life, because it's at the end of its rope. You know, in the run-up to the Russian Revolution, people said that it was the wrong time to attack the Tsar, because the very smallest peasant uprising was met with unimaginable shows of force. But it wasn't because the Tsar was at the peak of his power. It was because his power was slipping away. And we can't know until we join the fight whether we're fighting an all-powerful adversary or an adversary that is about to topple.
Yeah, exactly. Although you do have to say that in the modern, I don't even like to call it capitalism anymore because it has so few features of real capitalism. I mean, you don't bail out failing corporations using the state in traditional capitalist model. Sure. But anyway, it really has a lot of tools. And it's been, I mean, if you have to congratulate someone on doing something successfully, you know, controlling information and every possible vector, controlling the academe, creating a whole new sector, the think tank, you know, all of these things designed to reinforce. But at a certain point, you know, people smarten up because, you know, when you're starving to death, it's a real lived experience and no one can tell you that you're not starving to death.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And the story gets thinner by the day.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, in this world in which, at least for the moment, privacy, it seems to be nothing more than nostalgia, you know, let's get back to something that you've done, which is you've really pioneered an example, and you've already referred to this, that in this world where everyone seems to demand, you know, creative content, the product of creative brains for nothing, you found a way of both accommodating that, adjusting to it, and also finding a way for an artist to thrive. And if you could just briefly describe how you came upon the idea of working through a Creative Commons license, but also being able to published through traditional media, and whether you think that's a model that can be more broadly replicated by others.
Sure. I mean, it must be said that no artistic model has ever been broadly replicated, right? We have this incredible survivor bias. When we say, well, look at everybody who's a successful X did Y, we don't know how many of the people who did Y didn't become a successful X, right? They don't leave a mark, right? And so for all we know, it's just random chance, right? That everyone does Y because all the people who ever succeeded did Y. But there might be an A through Z lurking out there that we don't know about. And it also may be that almost everything everyone tries will fail. Which I think is generally the case in entrepreneurship and doubly the case in the arts and tragically the case in the arts, because at least entrepreneurs are slightly less manic in their willingness to produce even when the incentives are poor, whereas art is, you know, this kind of inbuilt compulsion for our species and then, you know, for some members of it more so than others. So when my first novel was due, I'd been publishing short stories for many years. I'd published a nonfiction book. My first novel was due, and I got word of the Creative Commons. I knew some of the people involved, including Aaron, and I spoke with my editor about it. My editor is now Vice President Macmillan, but was then the senior editor at Tor, which is my publisher in New York. He and I had met on online services in the 80s. He has no formal education. He dropped out of school when he was 14 to sleep on fans' couches across America and publish fanzines and ended up this very powerful editor. And he's a geek, right? He's always been involved in network communications. And so when I told him about this, he was like, you know, like I hear every ebook pitch there is. And I'm here to tell you that ebooks have the worst ratio of dollars in revenue generated to hours in meetings spent. Like, can't hurt. Right. And certainly like that, every, you know, book I ever loved, I got for free initially because, you know, it was loaned to me by a friend or I took it out of a library or whatever. It's, you know, like that's how people fall in love with books is that personal connection. And so, you know, why not? Let's try it. And it worked out really well. The book sold really well. The other book sold really well. Little Brother sold really well. The corporate culture at Macmillan eventually became such that they made me stop doing it in 2017. And, you know, we have a kind of natural experiment, although it's like not a perfect one because no two books are the same and no two moments are the same. But since then, I've had two books out from them and a third about to come out. One of them did really well. One of them did really badly. And the one that did really badly did really well in Canada, where it had a different distributor, but had in all other regards was the same book published by the same person in two adjacent countries. And so, you know, it seems more like a case of random chance than one or the other. Right. But making my works available under Creative Commons did ensure that no one ever had their internet account canceled because of me. No one was ever sued or legally threatened because of me, that my work found its way into a lot of hands that it never would have found its way into, you know, and I don't know if the numbers matter, right? And this is, we're getting into like the difference between statistics and anthropology or sociology and anthropology, but you know, the overall numbers are about are, you know, I think probably the same as any book. Some of them do well and some of them do poorly. But the thick description, the anthropology of the lived experience of the readers is really different, right? Yeah. The guy who was stationed on a Canadian aircraft carrier who printed it out and shared it with all the other people on the aircraft carrier, right? Or yeah. or the kid who had no money and who downloaded it, or the teacher in the poor school where they had no money who got all the kids to download it. I mean, that audience that I was able to reach, and those, that relationship that I built with those people, because they wrote to me to tell me about it, that has endured. And, you know, the way that I started the Attack Surface Kickstarter, the way that I initially promoted it, is I went through 16,000 pieces of fan correspondence in my little brother folder, and I replied to everyone.
Right.
And I said, right. Hey, there's this book. And I heard from people who said, you know, I wrote to you because I found your book and I downloaded it and this happened. I want to tell you what a profound effect it had on my life, the way I see technology, and the way that I relate to your work. I've never stopped reading it as a result of it. And, you know, I don't know if I buy Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans thesis, but I do think that people who admire your work and have an enduring affection for it are an asset that is far more important than the royalty that they represent. And asset's the wrong word. A community,
right?
That is far more important.
Yeah.
Right? That being embedded in a community of readers and writers who feel a sense of mutual obligation and respect is so much more important than the royalties that they generate, and ultimately generate royalties too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not taking a vow of poverty here. Right. But if the publishing industry collapsed tomorrow and I needed a kidney, I feel like I could do a crowdfunder that would bring people in who feel a sense of reciprocal obligation that comes from the performance of generosity through the Creative Commons license.
Yep.
That is at a much more intensely felt degree than merely having published books that they loved would have given me.
Yep. And you know, to put it in Glenn Gouldian terms, because that's who we are, his motto about what motivated him as an artist, which is spiritual nourishment. And I think that there's a lot of that in what you're describing. And I have a sort of a hypothesis, which is, you know, people love getting something for nothing. It can be irresistible, except when they know that it's at the expense of someone that they care about.
I think that's true. I think that, you know, appeals to people's moral sensibilities are complicated, and that lots of factors weigh in it. And that's definitely a really important one.
Yep. Yeah. I have just two more questions, and you've been beyond kind in terms of the time, but I have one that's really kind of an interesting sort of clash of ideas and values question, and then one that's a little closer to home for us, and then I promise we'll wrap. There is actually an interesting clash of values. There's certainly a strong libertarian strain that runs through Silicon Valley and Wall Street and certain aspects of the computing world, which is, if I have the ability to do it because of what I create or can imagine, you know, nobody has a right to stop it or curtail it. But at the same time, I sense that you are much more closely aligned in terms of your own values with, you know, a more communitarian strain of thought. But at the same time, you're the winner of 3 Prometheus Awards, which comes from the Libertarian Futurist Society. What gives with that? You're not a closet Randian, are you?
No. And I don't call myself a Marxist, but they've given prizes. I'm the child of 2 Marxists, and they've given prizes to at least two actual self-proclaimed Marxists. Yeah. So that, you know, give them this, right? They approach the work based on the values they see embedded in the work without regard to their political animus for the views of the author.
Right.
Which, you know, honestly is admirable. And I certainly wasn't going to turn them down. But, you know, I'll take my readers where I can find them, because the important thing is that they're reading the ideas. That all said, I think that, you know, the even self-proclaimed Randians are by and large not living the values, right? In the sense that, and Yochai Benkler made this point in a lecture he gave, that if you go down to Wall Street and you find a little playground where the brokers who are, you know, to a one self-proclaimed Randians are watching their kids play with the other kids, they're shouting at their kids, "Now, Billy, share," right? Because nobody wants to live with a kid
right.
who thinks Ayn Rand had good ideas?
Well, you know, I have this sort of sick theory that one of the reasons for the economic models we have is that a certain group of, let's say, emotionally defective people and capable of empathy, you know, thought, well, if people knew about this, they'd really scorn me. So I'll create a model that actually posits that everybody is that way, and then I can feel better about myself.
Well, it's definitely a good way to talk yourself into being a bastard is to convince yourself that everybody else would do the same if they were in your shoes.
Right.
And then, you know, the kind of self-deception reaches its apex when you assume that anyone who doesn't do it is a sucker.
Right.
Right. So like, and you have this, like, the most circular of all reasoning, right? Everybody secretly feels this way. And if someone doesn't, they're a sucker.
Right.
And the reason I'm allowed to do it is everyone feels this way. And then we should all take advantage of the suckers. I mean, it's a remarkably circular piece of reasoning.
But I'm scared that over time that a rationalization has become so pervasive that we're actually creating a self-fulfilling prophecy and giving birth to a race of homo economicus or homo economici.
Yeah, that's certainly a thing that we should worry about, right? I think that systems upregulate and downregulate different impulses that we have. And there's never been the person born who didn't have a selfish impulse or a banal or wicked one. And what you do in the moment of extremis is as much about the system that you're embedded in and what you think other people will do and whether you think you'll be caught if you fall as it is about your own moral character. And it's much easier to be a good moral actor when the consequences for someone else not reciprocating it are less.
Yes.
And so, you know, we can build a system that rewards cooperation, or we can build a system that pits people against each other. And, you know, you can see this playing out now in finance where, you know, Sears was taken over by this private equity firm that was, in addition to being a bunch of just rapacious looters, was also run by doctrinaire Randians. And the person who personally assumed management of Sears said to the people at Sears, enough of this collectivist nonsense where the person who runs the electronics division buys batteries from the person who runs the battery division. We are now in competition, and your salary depends on how your unit performs. And they produced every bizarre, you know, a perverse incentive that you could imagine, where the electronics division started buying batteries from, you know, no-name Chinese manufacturers, and the people who ran the shop floors started taking bids from different manufacturers, different wings of the company, to put different things at the front of the store, you know, because it, like, in their, like, little microcosm, you know, selling more washing machines was important, even if that ended up costing the business money. And the person who published the catalog raffled off the right, or auctioned off the right to, you know, feature your goods from Sears in the catalog. And they featured goods nobody wanted, because instead of that division making good goods that year, they saved their money to buy catalog space. And, you know, the whole business collapsed off the back of it.
We need a t-shirt with Ayn Rand's picture and a slogan, war of all against all or bust.
Well, and you know, she took a young Canadian lover. So
I know, that's, I know. You know, that's... She also took Social Security, and so did her society in the recent.
Yes. Yeah, they all took PPP. Although they claim the reason they did it is to be repaid for the endless theft that they have been subjected to by taxation.
Yeah, didn't I say before that the human power of rationalization is infinite?
Yeah, very powerful force indeed.
I'm going to have one more question, and then we'll wrap. So, Glenn Gould, since you're from Toronto, I think you're and you participated in a conference about him, was, if not a techno-utopian, certainly a techno-optimist, and I think he was fascinated by it. I'd like you to imagine if you had been one of the recipients of his 3 a.m. phone calls, what would you have liked to have chatted with Glenn about?
Oh, God, I have no idea. I mean, you know, when I talk to people like that, who are very good at a thing that I know nothing about and have no aptitude for, mostly I just ask them to nerd out. I mean, I would be like, I have an infinite supply of people I can talk about technology with. The number of people I can talk about the Goldman variations with is much smaller.
Right.
So Goldberg variations, beg your pardon. So I think I would have asked him about well-tuned pianos and much more than I would have talked to him about technology, to be honest.
Piano tuning, big subject.
Yeah.
I'm joking. Anyway, Corey, you've been fantastic. And I hope that, you know, some of the people who are tuning in actually don't know your work so that they'll have the opportunity to run out and discover it. And for those who are feeling pessimistic, because there's a lot to be pessimistic about, there actually are silver linings in a lot of your work. And I think that it's really an evocative meeting place for the time we're living in and what we're hoping we might actually be able to sort of work our way through to attain in the future, because if not, we're not going to be around to attain it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm just going to say a few words in closing. Thank you, everyone who hung in for the podcast with us. I do want to remind you again to like, share, subscribe, post comments. If you find anything that I or Corey have said deeply objectionable, you Randians out there, just pile on, let us know. But if you have liked what you've heard or want to add your own insights, please do. The Glenn Gould Foundation is a Canadian registered charity, and we rely on your support. So first of all, visit our website where there's tons and tons of interesting creative content. It's www.glenngould.ca, and check us out. And if you are feeling like, you know, even in these difficult times, you could manage to pry open a little increment of monetary emolument or two, please consider making a gift. And the last thing is that one of the things that we do that we're very proud of is the Glenn Gould Prize. It's an international arts award that some people have kindly compared to a Nobel Prize of the Arts. And our jury, an amazing, incredible international jury chaired by the great Laurie Anderson, will be meeting virtually in October. And we will be announcing the laureate via live streamed video conference at noon Eastern time on October 15th. It's a Thursday, and we hope that you'll join us. Check out our website, and we will post the links. And in the meantime, Corey, long success. Keep fighting the good fight and writing the good books. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Bye-bye. Well, friends, that brings our conversation with the amazing Corey Doctorow to an end. And I have to say, it was an eye-opener. Olivia, did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. I think Corey is just incredibly intelligent and brings some very, very valuable perspectives to the world of tech and surveillance, and has kind of made me question the ways in which I am being spied on.
Well, you've been listening in on this conversation throughout, so I had that feeling. But as you put some toast in your toaster, it's kind of a sobering thought that it might be actually watching you. So be careful what you say around your toaster or your refrigerator.
Yeah, it's more than just sourdough, hey?
Anyway, friends, thank you again. We have amazing programs to come. Please be sure to press like, share, and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode, and let your friends know about it. And if you're feeling generously disposed, please visit www.glenngould.ca. We are a Canadian registered charity, and your support would be very valuable in helping us to continue our work. And now, a little outro music, courtesy of Mr. Edison and his remarkable phonograph machine.